Okay, well, I think we'll get started. Welcome to our weekly CRECA lecture. I'm Yoshiko Herrera, the director of CRECA, and it's nice to see a lot of people here today. Before we get started with my formal introduction of Professor Diener, I just wanted to also introduce my colleague, David Detman, who is the director of the Center for, I'm going to get this wrong, I'm sorry, the American Center for Mongolian Studies, and also at the Center for East Asian Studies. And David is going to just say a few words about those organizations before we move to the formal introduction of Professor Diener.
So, thank you very much. My name is David. I work just upstairs at Center for East Asian Studies, but I spend half of my time also on an overseas research center, working for an overseas research center called the American Center for Mongolian Studies, ACMS for short. I wanted to kind of give you a little bit of an introduction because we're one of the co-sponsors. I'm actually representing two co-sponsoring organizations today, and we're very, very happy to do this. With Mongolia being placed in between our regions, this is a great event that we can do, and it's even our slot too. We have our guest lectures at this time on Thursdays as well, so it's a great thing to do together. I invite you to learn more about our organization. Our office is based in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. That's where our central office is located. We have a library, and our basic mission is to support research in Mongolia. So people who have projects who are working on things, doesn't matter if it's modern or historic, our mission is to support you. So I wanted to just give a shout out about we have fellowship programs available right now for summer. Most research in Mongolia is done in the summer, as you might imagine. There's a good reason for that. But we have money available. Please check us out. Our website is mongoliacenter.org. And if you have ideas about something that you would like to do collaboratively, or if you have an idea on a project that you'd like to do in Mongolia, I would be very happy to talk to you. I'm just upstairs in East Asian Studies. My name is David Detman. So representing my other center, East Asian, today, if you're up for it, there's another lecture happening at 6 p.m. in the Elvium. This is Chinese art history related, martial arts, cultural interactions between the civil and military in Ming China. This is in Elvium 140 at 6 p.m. That's all I have.
Okay.
But thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to host Alex Diener as well.
Okay, well, it's our great pleasure to host Professor Alexander Diener, who is also a PhD of this fine institution from the Geography Department. Right now, he is Assistant Professor of Geography at University of Kansas, so fellow Midwesterner. And his research interests revolve around issues of identity and territory in Mongolia and in the area. He has expertise in Central Asia, Mongolia, and the Islamic borderlands of Eurasia. We like this border crossing. He has held fellowships at George Washington University's Eries program in the Elliott School of International Affairs, also at the Kennan Institute, at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and he has been a regional research Fulbright scholar for Central Asia. Professor Diener is the author of One Homeland or Two, Nationalization and Transnationalization of Mongolia's Kazakhs, published by Stanford University Press and the Woodrow Wilson Center Press in 2009, and also Homeland Conceptions and Ethnic Integration Among Kazakhstan's Germans and Koreans, published by Mellon Press in 2004. He has a number of other publications in journals that I won't go into, but suffice it to say, he's a very distinguished scholar of the region. We're very happy to have him here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is a true pleasure to return to one's alma mater, one's doctoral alma mater in particular, because of the relationships that one really develops with faculty, Anatoly Hazanov, David Morgan, people like this, Yulesha Milulu. These are the people who really trained me and taught me, and I'm most grateful for the opportunity to come back. Let me begin this talk, as I do all my public talks, by announcing at the outset that I stutter. I do that so that if it crops up, we needn't pretend I'm not doing it. I'll know I'm doing it, you'll know I'm doing it. We will all eventually get everything out. Let me also confess that I may have overdone the slides a bit, attribute that to overzealousness at returning to the school that I love, and the fact that when looking at urban landscape change, good visuals are particularly important. So I hope you'll find this not only intellectually stimulating, but also visually so. in order to launch us in, with a bit of a theoretical framework, I'll do so a bit abstractly with this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is from an essay in 1836 entitled Nature, in which he states, "Miller owns this field, Locke that, and Manning the woodland beyond. But none of them owns the landscape. There is a property in the horizon which no man has but he whose eyes can integrate all the parts. That is, the poet. This is the best part of these men's farms, yet to this their warranty deeds give no title." This quote speaks to the essence of landscape as integrating the physical world and the social world, and also something more ethereal, some notion of meaning that resonates not so much in the mind, but in the heart and soul. So too, might we consider the idea of nation and in its relationship to the state. The very aim of nationalism is to conflate that which is physical, territory, and social, community, so as to create a bond that transcends logic and reason. Power and lands, the power of landscape has long been wielded by states to effect this conflation. Modern French philosopher Regis Debray has noted that states make themselves visible and heard through landscape. It is the theater of the state which creates the state, just as the monument creates memory. Landscape may therefore be regarded as a canvas or a forum for state expression, as a subtle or sometimes not so subtle for shaping the trajectory of the nation. In the case of Mongolia, landscape change may be seen as an ongoing effort at counter-distinction, reframing the nation in opposition to circumstances of recent domination and occupation. I'm sure most of us have some awareness of this, but I'll go ahead and provide a little bit of contextual data to get us rolling. Mongolia is a landlocked state in Northeast Asia that often tragically gets overlooked or caught between world regions, especially those defined by funding agencies. For much of the Eurasian, aka post-Soviet funding agencies, it often gets waved off as East Asia. For the East Asian agencies, it's often overlooked as being too nomadic in character, the other side of the wall, post-Soviet, and thus kind of trapped between two funding worlds. Its population size is roughly 3 million people. That's an estimate of around 2011. It's got a population density of roughly 0.6 per square kilometer. That's one of the lowest in the world. Now, this density varies, with the largest percentage being in the center. Population growth, I would also add, has varied throughout time, with it being rather low in the early Marxist-Leninist period, picking up to the late Marxist-Leninist period, and then dropping off again in the post-Soviet period, thus creating a population pyramid like this, giving this sort of tapering effect that often suggests a certain level, reaching a certain level of development. What I'd like to talk about now, though, is how mobile pastoralism has been the primary influence on Mongolian culture. Mongolia's climate and landscape are ecologically well-suited to mobile pastoralist processes. Herders traditionally move with the seasons, thereby allowing grassland recovery. Traditional pastoralism, however, was dramatically altered by Soviet collectivization into ranches known as negdels. And the trend towards semi-nomadic herding has therefore predominated over the last century. Nevertheless, Mongolian traditions of mobile pastoralism remain quite visible, and to most Mongolian citizens signify the uniqueness not only of their place in Northeast Asia, but in the world. Current pastoralism is an adaptation to the new free market reforms that began in 1990. Privatization of land, animals, and equipment occurred at this time, but often with grand questions as to equity in that redistribution. There's a growing dichotomy between rich and poor herders. Of the 243,000 household defined as pastoralist families, it's about 601 are estimated to have above 1,000 animals, with about 166,000 having below 100 animals, with 100 being the subsistence level. Now, many of these challenges to transition had been masked during the Marxist-Leninist period by the communist support systems. Here, we're looking at things like harsh terrain, population growth, property, unemployment, educational decline, and a lot of the decline in support services. We're often masked by the subsidies of Moscow. When those subsidies were pulled back, you saw many of these issues come to the fore. The response to this was usually population redistribution. Now, population redistribution in Mongolia has its own story. Poor herders moved to the urban areas following the collapse of the Marxist-Leninist regime in the 1990s. In the early to mid-90s, we saw a reversal of this trend. Now, some people moving back to the countryside. Now, some attribute this to a romantic reclamation of their suppressed nomadic heritage, but my interviews suggest that it was far more of an instrumental choice to seek sustenance with relatives that had never abandoned the old ways. Many of those who left the city were not terribly successful in the countryside, nor terribly comfortable. Today, urbanization is once again very prominent. These urbanizing migrants, including not only former city dwellers, but young people seeking the modern in Mongolia, and particularly those affected by recent jut and drought. This map is a rather crude map displaying the origins of many of these migrants. You'll see that the primary groups are coming from the central, north central, and west regions. Just to give some sense of the scale of this urban flow and the idea of the drivers of this urbanization, I'll point to the fact that as of 2011, Mongolia was 57% urban, and 38% living in the capital city of Ulaanbaatar. The rate of urbanization is about 1.2% of the annual rate of change. That's an estimate between 2005 and 2010, with 36% of Mongolia's population living below the poverty line. That's about 43% in the rural areas and about 30% in the urban areas. Now, the modern city of Ulaanbaatar developed piecemeal over time. The new Soviet architecture often replaced older forms of architecture, with various parts of the city following patterns of development relating to a particular phase of Soviet planning that was in play at that given time. We'll see some pictures of this later. The most obvious and impacting aspect of the recent phase of urbanization is the growth of the Ghare suburbs, sometimes known as the mushroom suburbs because of the golden tops or the white tops of the yurts and Ghares. The rural population has about 78% living in Ghares, the urban population about 28%. Many of these Ghares have little or no services. The sanitation is a particular problem. Historically, we saw communications as a problem, but the cell phone is becoming far more broadly available, and that's solving some of these issues. The Ghares of Ulaanbaatar, however, are noted that most do, in fact, have electricity. However, they are still often burning dung and wood, thus creating a serious ecological problem. The city of Ulaanbaatar is in a valley, and thus they get a temperature inversion. Much of this smog gets trapped, and they're having severe respiratory problems in the city of Ulaanbaatar. Few of these Ghares have running water, with about 20% using open boreholes, or 20% having access to spring water, and about 80% having access to boreholes. There are disadvantages to living in these peri-urban settlements, as there are disadvantages throughout the world in peri-urban settlements. A high percentage of income goes to water, health care, and education. Only about 44% of the population has access to improved water. And also the degradation of the Ghare. The Ghare was meant to be set up, struck, set up again. In that process, maintenance was always engaged. With the establishment of the Ghare in the city, one doesn't engage in that kind of maintenance, and they've seen dramatic degradation of Ghares. The Ghare suburbs also represent major problems for city planners. These include air pollution, water pollution, services overburdened or non existed. And also increasingly the economic and social problems, where a lot of people are attributing the ills of the city to the Gare suburbs. These include unemployment, crime, and also disease patterns. One of the more broadly known is this issue of underground children in Mongolia, of a homeless population of roughly 10,000. It is estimated that some between 1,000 and 4,000 children exist in some of the underground regions of the city. And here I'll just show you a few pictures of the very Gare suburbs. What you can see here is one on some of the flatter area to the east of the city. Here you see some of the pictures of the fencing and some of the permanent structures that have been established as people have been there over the years. And I think this one does a nice job of showing the production of that smog that then moves down into the city and is trapped by the temperature inversion. There are nevertheless great advantages to the peri-urban settlements. Access to education, healthcare, about 60% of Mongolia's medical doctors live in the city of Ulaanbaatar. And the economic opportunity beyond the agricultural sphere, in essence, access to modernity. And there's this abstract notion that draws a lot of young people to the city. The peri-urban settlements around Ulaanbaatar reflect the complex negotiation of traditional ways of living and the formation of modern Mongolia. Some would argue that modernity is, in fact, hegemonic. We see here from Dora Nagpal's 2006 article reference to the idea that even though Gare families leave the city for short periods of time during the summer, many Mongolian children will now grow up without the pastoral tradition and deep knowledge of their forefathers, making it impossible for them to return to that lifestyle. They go on to state that the main difference between earlier population movements and recent ones is that while the former were temporary and people retained their nomadic identities, the latter are more or less permanent. This draws from a larger discourse pertaining to the trajectory of the Mongolian nation. Among the most notable champions of modernization in the state is Batur bin Batbayar, otherwise known as Babur, who stated in 1996, the purity of the Mongolian society has already been irreparably corrupted by 70 years of Soviet dominance and its Western influence. To retain nomadic cultural paradigms as the core of the nation-making process is to relegate the state to a living museum. This idea was taken up by then Prime Minister, later President, and now imprisoned Namrin Ikhbayar, who stated in 2001, it is not my desire to destroy the original Mongolian identity, but in order to survive, we have to stop being nomads. Now, this debate as to the place of mobile pastoral heritage in Mongolia and in a Mongolian national ideal is not new, as demonstrated by the work of Uryadin Bulag. Even during Soviet times, there was an effort to represent this core aspect of Mongolian culture. But as you'll note, it was often adorned with various socialist symbols. Note the Soyumbu here at the center of the star. It was with the collapse, though, of the Marxist-Leninist regime in 1990, however, that this debate became most public and most existential for the now independent Mongolian elite responsible for setting the trajectory of the state. This political cartoon reads, so all we have for 70 years is that they say horses should be transported in trucks and eaten. Let's go home before it's too late. This political cartoon relates to the questions related to modernization. On the left, if a white falcon is drawn into the emblem, will it be uncontrollable later? This relates to a discourse that they wanted to almost mimic the American eagle, but there was concern that it would become this sort of powerful thing that would fly away with the country. The picture on the right reads, if the horse remains in the emblem, will it be lazy and wag its tail later? Thus, the idea that if they too overtly retain this mobile pastoralist cultural heritage, will that hamstring the nation in its effort to advance into modernity? Ultimately, this debate was settled with a national symbol that kind of represents both. One that reflects the emerging hybridity and exemplifies the contemporary Mongolian life. Note the mythical winged horse with the Soyumbu embedded in the middle. Now, these photos, I hope, will also demonstrate that hybridity as it is lived in everyday life. Note the woman dressed in traditional Mongolian garb about to board a plane to transport her self-shorn cashmere to a foreign market where it will fetch a higher price. These hardy chaps here were my guides as I traveled the steppe in this Soviet Uaz, all the time using these deer stones or human stones as directional markers. Here again we see the mix of the Soviet era, the post-Soviet era, and the globalization and history. This hybridity is not, however, strictly driven by advancing modernity on a passive traditionalism. Quite the contrary, there are active proponents of setting mobile pastoralist tradition at the core of the Mongolian national project. This quote is telling as to the quasi-self-essentialism advanced by this camp. It states, "The Mongols divide the world into those who live within earth walls and those who live within felt walls. From the nomad's point of view, the sedentary life still appears rather miserable." Now, perhaps the quintessential commentary on this negotiation of sociocultural ideals is offered by the famed Mongolian writer Mendelyu, who states, "Mongolia's transition to the market economy is shaking the foundations of traditional nomadic life. Traditions and heritage of 1,000 years are being forgotten. Today, both settled and nomadic civilizations exist simultaneously in Mongolia. Will they remain side by side, or will one dissolve into another? Settlement threatens the nomads." He goes on to advocate for some form of middle ground in which the traditional and the modernity, in which tradition and modernity can coexist. "I wish," he argues, 21st century nomads could be well-educated and intelligent. It is obvious that nomadic civilization cannot remain as it was in the past. Why can't nomads have electricity thanks to wind generators? Why can't they have mobile phones? Why can't we improve traditional gear so it is comfortable in all seasons? Then nomads would not settle down. Rather, movement would flow from the cities to the countryside, and busy city life would stand in admiration of nomadic civilization. I would argue that this adaptive hybridization is precisely what the city of Ulaanbaatar has demonstrated throughout its history. The city began as a mobile monastery, or ger terek, in 1639. It was established as a sedentary settlement known as Khuri in 1778, though I believe this date is debated by some historians. The settlement then changed names multiple times, reflecting the shifting geopolitical winds of the era. It's really with the Qing dynasty, though, which ruled from 1691 until 1911, that we get some of the main factors of this permanent settlement. Some of the settlement location factors included its proximity to prominent rivers, caravan routes, and also the Bol Khan Mountain, which was considered sacred and had become a pilgrimage site, and thereby justifying the sedentary settlement of certain Mongolian Buddhist elite and the establishment of a Chinese trading post nearby. The architecture of the early city was highly influenced by this nexus of cultures: Buddhist, Mongolian, Tibetan, and Chinese. In these slides, we can see some of these, we can see the reflections of the history in contemporary architectural stylings. Note the ger or yurt style of this particular monastery, rounded with the curved roof. Here, we can see the Mongolian ger structure in the foreground with the pagoda style or Tibetan influence building in the background. With this one, we see, with this monastery, it evokes both the Chinese and Tibetan styles, hence that whole notion of hybridization. At the fore of the city's development was, however, the Bol Khan, considered among the top-ranking lamas of the Buddhist world. Independence came in 1911, which followed a plebiscite with the declaration of Mongolia's separation from the, or outer Mongolia's separation from the Chinese empire. A Chinese warlord named Zhu Shujing took over in 1919, who was ultimately then displaced by Baron Ungern von Sternberg, otherwise known as the Bloody White Baron, who succeeded in killing off many of the lamas of the city, as well as most of the city's Jewish population. The Red Army replaced him, led largely by Sukhbatar and Choi Balsan. And you have then the Russian and Soviet influence taking over in 1920-24 and moving forward from there until 1990. Two very prominent characters here factor in as we launch into our analysis of the modern capital. Key figures of the founding of the Mongolian communist state were Sukhbatar and Choi Balsan, Sukhbatar being a Mongolian military hero who died relatively early on in the process, and then Choi Balsan, who was a highly debated figure within Mongolian historiography. Some portray him as a shrewd leader who declared Mongolia the second socialist state in the world, and by doing so prevented its annexation by the Soviet Union proper. Others portray him as a puppet of Stalin, who took his proxy as a mechanical despot of the state, purging many of the Buddhist lamas, also many of the Muslim mullahs, and raising the religious landscape with some 800 Buddhist monasteries destroyed under his reign. He also converted about 2,300 religious buildings into secular purposes. While mosques were rather rare at this time, he successfully destroyed most of the Qurans in the country, as well as anyone who could actually read them. Though nominally independent, though, Mongolia is often referred to as the 16th Republic of the Soviet Union. Starting in the 1920s and 30s, then getting momentum toward the World War II era, Russian and Soviet influence began to shape the architecture of the city. We can see here the Winter Palace of the Bol Khan, built in a classical Russian style. That's one of the few buildings that actually predates 1930 that still remain in the building, in the city. With shifts in Soviet ideology, we also see shifts in the Mongolian Ulaanbaatar landscape. This is as obvious in Ulaanbaatar as it is in other Eastern Bloc countries. We see here the revolutionary style of architecture, which ultimately gave way to the classicism and mass production of the Stalinist era. Here's another example of that. You can see the columns in this kind of classic Stalin tower. We then move forward here, and you see the juxtaposition of the sort of block style Stalinist building with the neoclassical stylings here. By the early 1970s, though, there started to become grumblings among many of the architects throughout the Soviet realm as to the uniformity of the construction styles during the rapid construction period of Khrushchev and Brezhnev. Though this building is clearly a Soviet-style building, you can see that the accoutrements at the top are sort of a tip of the cap to its Asian setting. This would be continued into the post-Soviet period, as they often attempted to build buildings, often using old plans, but trying to add on to them just a few extras that would give the impression of it being Mongolian in form. This picture here is of a hotel built near Ulaanbaatar, very much in an Asian style here, but also very, very importantly here, the silver tree, which was mimicking that which was allegedly in Chinggis Khan's Kharkhorum. The original tree allegedly spewed out mead, mead, beer, some type of kumis, and something else. This one spews out no alcohol at all. I checked. All right. What we also saw, though, was this effort to Mongolianize many of the architectural styles within Ulaanbaatar, and you saw the creation of these mega gare buildings. Some interviews suggested that people thought this pedantic and sometimes disrespectful of that traditional style, in that these are made of concrete and stone and don't move, but they were built to look like gares. They felt that it was sort of a dishonest homage to the local stylings. Perhaps the most important example of this is the Wrestling Palace, built in the center of the city, again, built in that gare style. Now, these efforts to express national heritage in architecture stand in stark contrast to the modernist glass buildings that have arisen around the city center. This one is actually called the meat cleaver or the sailboat by many of the local Ulaanbaatar residents. Where one could actually trace the style of building to a chronology of Soviet ideology and leadership historically, with certain buildings being Khrushchev era, Brezhnev era, and moving on. This has now become interspersed with the realities of Mongolia's emergence on the international stage. Such that we now see a hodgepodge of architecture, a juxtaposition of styles in a complex conversation about the trajectory of the Mongolian nation. Now, if you'll allow me to change gears a bit here and refocus from architecture to public art, we can see a similar evolution leading to the contemporary hybridity that personifies the state and the complex negotiation of ideals relating to traditionalism and modernity. At the center of Sukhbatu Square still stands the statue of the communist era hero Sukhbatu. There is some talk of coating him in bronze because the statue is starting to degrade, but nevertheless he remains at the center of that square. Where Stalin has been removed from virtually all post-socialist cities, including from in front of the National Library in Ulaanbaatar, Choi Bal-sang remains here in front of the National University, thus reflecting his debated status in the Mongolian national narrative. Until just a couple weeks ago, Lenin statues still existed quite prominently in the city. This one in front of the Ulaanbaatar Hotel was just removed a couple of weeks ago. This reflects the degree to which many Mongolian citizens acknowledge the contributions of the Soviet patron state to their development, and this complex process of trying to come to terms with that Soviet era. Christopher Kaplansky, I think, has written very interesting about this. A similar acknowledgement is available in the retention of street names, Engels Avenue, People's Boulevard, each of which were very common throughout the Soviet realm. We shall see if further de-Sovietization occurs, though, in the coming months. That will be interesting to track. Such an effort to live with, though minimize, the Soviet era iconography accompany resurrections of traditional icons that fell into disfavor during the Marxist-Leninist period. The giant golden Buddha in the Zaisan district is an example, but I think this is also a very telling photo in that in the background you can see the Soviet war memorial still stands on the high ground. Now, not only are Buddhist symbols and practices rebounding in Mongolia, but so too are different shamanistic stylings and traditional religious practices and iconography. This is an ovos around which one walks three times and contributes a rock. They were very often destroyed or forbidden during the Soviet period. Now, efforts to capitalize on the rebounding pride of historic Mongolian tradition have manifested in a variety of advertising schemes. The most prominent of which, however, centers on the person of Chinggis Khan. Denounced as a feudal warlord during the Marxist-Leninist period, the last two decades have seen Chinggis Khan recast in the Mongolian national narrative as a beloved father of the nation as well as a progenitor of other Eurasian states deriving from their nomadic tradition. The great statue standing just outside of Ulaanbaatar, argued to be the largest freestanding equestrian statue in the world, is an interesting example. It has a tourist center with a museum, cafes. You can take an elevator up to the horse's keister and then walk up here and look out through his ears. Very interesting because it gives this impression of being high, staring out the way Chinggis Khan looked not only to the future, but to the horizon, and thus the idea of expansion. Quite an interesting story here. There is a tourist center that is developing around it that has both horses and gares so that tourists can see what it would have been like to ride with the great Khan, living in the gares, riding the horses. See, there's some horse tracks out there. But he's also, you know, He's not only represented in grand statuary throughout the city. You also see him in several other forms. Vodka bottles, watches, coins, murals. And particularly look at this statue. This impressive statue was erected directly in front of the new Mongolian government building. it replaces the mausoleums of Choi Bal Sam and Sukhbath. Note, however, his depiction not as a warrior, but as a teacher and a ruler. He's not even really armed. This speaks to a conscious reorientation of the nation from its aggressive past to a peaceful democratic future. Democracy is argued by many to be a byproduct of nomadic heritage, a legacy of Chinggis Khan's Yasa Code. The Yasa Code, which I can't really go into too much detail here, but argued for many very interesting ideas, such as the rule of law, pluralism, personal freedoms. Different people can be united into one independent nation, participatory democracy, and so on. Well, this has been taken up by recent by contemporary political pundits. Jama has argued that we are, I should say, very liberal. We put humans above the state. The sun revolves around the human being. We stand for human rights and freedoms. This, you should understand, is very non-Asian. It conflicts with Asian traditions. What makes this country different from other Asian countries is its nomadic heritage. The state existed but never interfered much in people's lives. Levels of personal freedom here in the United States and in the United States are very comparable. This is clearly a very interesting kind of self-essentializing notion that helps distance Mongolia from some of its Asian neighbors. Now, this perception of Mongolia as democratic, welcoming, and peaceful, so has not always been the case. We know this from this historic film with John Wayne, The Conqueror. But even today, the Kazakhstani film in industry has taken to depictions of Mongols in various films as warlike and enemies of the Kazakh people. We see it here, we see it in this one, and we also see it here in this most recent one in Zhazhurek Minbala, which portrays three martial arts wielding Kazakhs who are able to fend off a large scale Dzungar or Oirat invasion. It is here that I will speak briefly about the effect of resetting the trajectory of the Mongolian nation on its largest ethnic minority community, the Kazakhs. I've written a book about the Kazakh community and have maintained an interest in their development over the years. This slide shows the distribution of Kazakhs within Mongolia. They came to this region and lived side by side with Mongols after a period of some contestation. But many Kazakhs represent their place within Mongolia as a sanctuary, that they were given a home, that they came and were welcomed in. During the times of collectivization in the Soviet Union, during the famines, they were able to flee and were given a home and citizenship within Mongolia. They have, even in the Marxist-Leninist period, however, lived in a very unique duality of isolation and insulation, in which they were far enough away from Ulaanbaatar to avoid Mongolization that might have come from being too close to the power center of the state, but they were also marginal to the development process, both during and after the Soviet period. They can also argue to be part of Chinggis Khan's broader legacy as a certain strand of Kazakh elite, the white bone elite, derived from the line of Chinggis Khan. And perhaps most importantly, they have been included in the territorial or civic national processes of the Mongolian statehood through their claim to nomadic and pastoral heritage. They are Turgatan, or fellow felt tent dwellers. And it's that has really enabled them to feel a sense of belonging in this country. What's rather interesting is the Kazakhs have been offered this sense of being part of the Mongolian nation to a far greater extent than many Mongols living outside of the borders of Mongolia, including many of the Halka Mongol of Inner Mongolia, Buryats, and Tuvans of Russia. Now, the rising emphasis on Mongolian tradition, however, raises questions as to the commitment to this civic national trajectory. An additional factor is the shifting globalization and transnational linkages that are manifesting at rapid speed in Mongolia today. Now, they may in fact manifest as positives or perhaps negatives for the Kazakh community. Examples would be the plans for the Millennium Highway. They have the potential to shatter this isolation-insulation paradigm in which the Mongolian Kazakhs have existed throughout their history here, not only by connecting them to Ulaanbaatar, the center of Mongolian power, but also to a broader Central Asian world, such as connections across the border into Kazakhstan, into Russia, and other places. What we'll see here, though, here's an example of some of these this uptick that has occurred recently in terms of the economy. Mongolia's growing role in the global economy, however, is also reflected in the cityscape and its embrace of new symbols of globalization. These include the Gandhi statue, symbolizing the collective commitment to peace, but also the Marco Polo statue, symbolizing their embrace of linkages to the world. Another example is, of course, the Beatles monument, which symbolizes that all you need is love. It also symbolizes my interviews on this topic have occurred here in Almaty, where there's also a Beatles statue, Ekaterinburg, where there's also a Beatles statue, and I just asked why. What was the reason for this? And the answer that I usually get is, this shows that we have access to global culture now. During a period of time when we were teenagers, there's a particular generation driving this, that says when we were teenagers, we weren't allowed to. All we got was the Beatles through the Voice of America. And it was always cluttered with that KGB jazz, that static. And they fell in love with the Beatles then. But now that they're free, they're arguing that they can go ahead and build this Beatles statue. And they have. All right. What else do we have here? Today, a new Mongolian government building stands as a symbol of the complex negotiation of tradition, communist legacy, and globalization. It stands on the site where protests have erupted to reject corruption and to demand a true voice for the people. The origin, the original champion of this cause, the murdered golden magpie of democracy, Zorig, is memorialized on a side street near the post office, while the new benevolent image of Chinggis Khan stands above the central square. If we look to the countryside, we can see the advent of new hybridities between the global and the traditional. Some of these can be argued to be very positive, but some are clearly very negative. The Ger suburbs continue to grow in Ulaanbaatar and signify a problem of national poverty, while the skyscrapers mark a new era of prosperity for the Mongolian state. We find in Mongolia a unique juxtaposition, if not conflation, of the historic nomadic and the modern sedentary lifestyles. But what I would argue is, has this not always been the case? A complex, sometimes symbiotic, sometimes conflictual relationship between the two civilizational styles. I would argue that it occurred historically, and it continues to occur today. I would argue that the city of felt and concrete makes this point eminently clear, but that this is not just a study of Ulaanbaatar, that this can be extrapolated, that we can use this as a model, as I have recently done some work on Bishkek in the same framework, which is intended to speak broadly to the change that is occurring across the post-socialist realm, where capital cities hold unique positions in the political symbolic regimes of these states. They were formed and reformed with particular attention to the ideals and intended socio-political goals of elites holding power at particular times. As power shifts, it is common to see rapid and sometimes radical changes in street names, architectural styles, urban development projects, zoning laws, and perhaps most prominently, the placement and replacement of statuary. My work on this topic attempts to view the urban landscape as a forum for debate, negotiation, and contestation. As new elites seek to reorient the socio-cultural and political economic trajectories of their respective states. Although these new regimes often employ the rhetoric of creating a new city, people, nation, or state, They never operate from a blank slate. The closest examples are purpose-built capital cities, mostly commissioned in post-colonial contexts, such as Washington, D.C., Brasilia, Astana, Canberra, or Abuja. Yet even here, governments have faced significant constraints to embedding markers of the new collective memory in urban space. This includes the persistence of previous iconographies, sometimes removed, relabeled, or reinterpreted. Preferences regarding architectural styles, sometimes raised, moved, or refaced. And popular perceptions of urban spatiality, contested, debated, and negotiated. What we see and must decode are the hybrid landscapes and narratives that are negotiated through the existing socio-spatial order. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I think the floor is open for questions.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in how this hybridity works itself out in terms of nationalist feelings being a Mongolian. So if it's a past of nomadism, how is it differentiated from being a Kazakh or being from Inner Mongolia? Or if it's Buddhism, how does that affect the nationalism? In other words, what I'm asking is there a particular valence of one issue that drives identity as a Mongolian?
During my research on the Mongolian Kazakhs, this was a particularly important question, because the argument that was continually made was, no, we belong here, because they often pointed to these Turkic gravesites that predate Kazakhs. But they said, we have ancestors here. We opened our eyes here. We were born here. But in terms of the rhetoric coming from Ulaanbaatar, they were included because they were part of the state when it became independent in the post-socialist period. They were inside those borders. And thus, they often looked, the argument was, from Mongols in Mongolia, that the inner Mongols were sometimes waved off as Chinese. They were too agricultural. The Buryats and Tuvans sometimes got waved off as somewhat Rusified. But oddly, the Kazakhs were welcomed in. And part of that relates to, and I didn't show it here, but there were a number of statues that were built that actually showed Kazakhs participating in the defense of Mongolia against the Japanese during World War II. And I thought that was a particularly interesting way. So I don't think it's just one thing, because if they focus on Buddhism, you can see the Kazakhs feeling a little bit pushed off. So they kind of pick their own particular path that they say, you're in. And the Kazakhs kind of follow along and say, we'll take it.
If I may, the reason I asked that question was that a lot of the rhetoric of nationalism, say, that arises in Turkey, in Istanbul, is coming together of Turkic peoples, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, etc. So I was wondering how these two tectonic plates hit each other.
Yeah, and I think Turkey's interesting too, because if you look at how it evolved, wasn't there a time when Ataturk made a choice to ground the nation of Turkey in the soil of the Anatolian Peninsula, rather than reach out into some grand pan-Turkic idea? So you can see how these things evolve and change. It's interesting, right?
Yeah, I'm interested in learning the central government population. Do they organize the kind of a most of them are the real Mongolia, or how many Kazakhs be able to serve in the central government?
Let's see. What was it? There were three seats reserved for Kazakhs in the parliament, and they were consistently provided this. And then I think there, by an Olgi, they started to do much more appointing of local Kazakhs to particular positions there, which gave them a sense of being represented, of having voice. But I'm pretty sure there are three positions held specifically for ethnic Kazakhs.
How big that organization is? What you mentioned, I mean, you say three seats reserved for Kazakhs, but
how many is it?
No, that was a question. Three out of how many?
Yeah, that's a good question. You guys don't know how many is in there?
Mongolia's parliament has 76 seats.
Yeah, so 76 or so.
76 seats.
That's right. Yeah, it's been a while since I was working on that particular issue, but thank you, appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, you showed this awesome map of the migration, or like the dots,
yeah,
of the Kazakhs in Bayan Olgi and also in Ulan Bator. I was wondering exactly where do the Kazakhs, the Mongol Kazakhs that migrate, reside within the city? Is it the city center? Is it in the Gare districts? And how much, I guess, where they reside, the space-place complex could affect their, I guess, integration into Mongolian society?
That's a good question. In terms of migrations within Mongolia, I've seen much more chain migration, where they've gone and found a Kazakh family that exists there, and they've moved in somewhere nearby. But the far more prominent migration today is, of course, migration to Kazakhstan. And that has its own story of the Kazakhstani government trying to direct people to particular places. Sometimes that not actually holding, and they migrated then within Kazakhstan to find better jobs, better weather, or people who lived where they lived.
Thank you very much for your thorough talk. I'm interested in citizenship. Do people gain access to services like education and health services, do they have to be a citizen? And if so, does citizenship cause a problem for those who don't have citizenship? Is it difficult to obtain citizenship? Are there controversies about citizenship in the country?
Within Mongolia?
Yes.
Yeah, the most of the migrants to Ulaanbaatar living in the Gare suburbs are Mongolian citizens and thereby have access to certain things. But the overburdening of the system is the problem, that they keep coming and they keep coming, and the system is already heavily burdened, and that is causing a lot of tension, not just where people are simply looking and saying, you know, we have what are all these gears on the hillside, but what impact are they having on our city? And that's where a lot of this stuff about crime and all that, a lot of it gets pointed at the Gare suburbs. And also this issue of smog. You know, there are certainly far more cars today than there were a few years ago, but it's pretty clear that a lot of this smog is coming from the use of the burning of coal, the burning of wood, and the burning of dung, and it's getting settled in the city. And respiratory problems are an increasingly serious problem.
Yeah, about the Gare suburbs, I guess it's a very fascinating talk, by the way. But it's an interesting even term to call it a suburb, because I guess I'm trying to understand, should we think of this as a slum in the way we think of other mega, I mean, I know that word has negative connotations, but I'm just trying to understand the kinds of people that are moving in and the choices. You know, is this a phenomenon like in other countries where people are moving into the cities and you have sort of people just set up sort of temporary-ish settlements outside the cities, but they always would move into the city if they had more money or if they had more resources or something like that? And in this case, do people move out of the concrete buildings and into the Gare suburbs, or is this, I mean, that is, are there people choosing to live in the Gare suburbs even if they could live someplace else, or how to exactly understand this?
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of people moving out of the Blockies and into the Gare suburbs. The peri-urban aspect here is really worth researching because it is unique. Yes, in some of the areas you are seeing some of those ramshackle kind of constructs of various structures, but the Gare really is such an efficient
well-made structure, that people are feeling like they can move there, live within it, problem again coming, that it's not meant to be left up year after year after year. In terms of movement around, there have been great improvements made to some of these GARE homes. People have actually put up fences. You can see here, fences. They've put up permanent structures. There's been gardening. There's been collective gardening efforts. There are NGOs there that are trying to organize people, particularly women's groups, to try to have active gardening in particular areas to provide and make up for some of these lacking services. So it's tough to really categorize it as a slum. There are parts that are kind of new and dirtier, but there seems to be an effort to try to make them cleaner and make them more efficient. So in that sense, I really think it is a unique peri-urban settlement that deserves to be looked at in contrast to some of these other ones that we see in Latin America and Africa and other places.
Yes. Say a few words about, you said you've done work in Bishkek's periphery as well, and I spent a little time there, I'm sure a lot less than you, but it was interesting to see, at least in a few places, sort of permanent roads going in and things being formalized and concretized, and, you know. Not that it was felt beforehand, but it seemed like that would be a really interesting terrain of this hybrid urban landscape in contention there. So how does that compare to, are similar things going on here? Is that even representative of Bishkek in your experience?
Yeah, Bishkek has less of this sort of GARE living structure. It ends up being much more of that ramshackle, a little bit more feeling, has that feel of impoverishedness, more so. A lot of my work there related to these the new nationalism that is existing. One of the classic examples being the change of that one statue, that one area, where they took out Lenin, they put in Erkendik, they replaced Erkendik with Manas. And in this whole process, you see these like this complex public negotiation of who are we? And I think that these what doesn't get talked about a lot there are those peri-urban settlements that are developing at the outskirts of Bishkek. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just had a quick question about the Lenin statue that you mentioned, the one in Ulaanbaatar. So people accepted that as part of the urban landscape for 20 years. Yeah. What suddenly happened in year 21 where there was a call to take it down?
Yeah, it just happened two weeks ago, and I have a paper coming out on this. It's in press, and I had to call and say, "Hang on a second, that's not there anymore. I got to change that line." In Bishkek, they did a similar thing. Well, the Lenin statue was put up in 1984, and it wasn't taken down until 2003. And that is an interesting moment when it was the Akayev regime deciding it needed to step in and push off that from that past. Some people say that it's because Western funders come in and they were uneasy because of the prominence of this Soviet symbol, but he made a serious mistake by then establishing the Erkendik statue, which came in with a great cultural faux pas. It was a woman holding a tunduk. She was holding it in her left hand. Normally women don't touch the tunduk, and they certainly don't do it with their left hand. She had a exposed breast, short hair. It was just a sense that a lot of people reacted against the Erkendik statue. I didn't hear about anything like that here. I didn't hear that in Mongolia there was this big down with Lenin. In fact, as I mentioned, Kaplansky's done some really interesting work about how they've almost done their sort of peace and reconciliation type of thing to come to terms with that Soviet past, where they've actually built new statues to Soviet era leaders to show that those guys made a great impact on us. And usually Mongolian Soviet era leaders, they're not reaching out and building a new statue to Dzerzhinsky or something like that, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anybody going up in his place? I ask because for years I've been telling people Lenin's still there in Ulaanbaatar, and if I hadn't come along today, I wouldn't have known why I'd have stopped saying that.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not decided yet, is it?
It was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I caught it, and I called people, and they were like, "Yeah, he's gone." I'm not sure. Is the one in front of the Children's Museum though still there? There was a Lenin there, and there was one in front of the Ulaanbaatar Hotel. I'm not sure if the Children's Museum one was. What was taken down, so we'll see.
And just about the Mongol ambiguous attitude to the recent past. On the same square where the statue to Chaibalsan is located, just in the opposite corner, there is a very small semi-private museum devoted to the victims of the Chaibalsan Road.
Right.
You can see it through the windows, his statue, but in the museum, you'll find out that this guy managed to exterminate 7% of the whole population of Mongolia in just 3 years, from 1931 to 1934. So very ambiguous attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been in this museum?
Yes, I have.
It's a very small museum.
Yeah, I, and interestingly, a similar ambiguity exists in Bishkek, where you have, in Alato Square, you have Manas here, straight across from you, you have the new Chinggis Aitmatov statue. And then at the angle here, you have the old Soviet People's Friendship statue, and behind the museum is Lenin. What's interesting is, I came across a quote from Chinggis Aitmatov where he talked about how it was when they were putting up the Lenin statue. He was talking about how lucky the Kyrgyz people were to have had their fates entwined with the Russian people, how marvelous, it was great. And at the same time, though, recently, he was coming to terms with the fact that his father, the mass grave site in near Talas, was actually found. And one of the other big ones was the 1916 monument that was built outside of Bishkek. That they really questioned.
Alex, I have another comment. There is an interesting development in Mongolia and in Kazakhstan as well. While literally millions of former pastoralists are moving to the cities, Ulaanbaatar, Almaty, and a few other big cities in Kazakhstan, the number of stock in the countries is not decreasing, and sometimes even rising. Quite a new development is taking place. Relatively few rich stock owners now are involved in market-oriented production, using hired labor. So it is quite a new development. You see, contrary, different to the previous situation. Is it fair? Life is not fair. But the problem is that with regard to the stock numbers, you see, both countries are doing quite well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of my conversations with
I have statistics.
Yeah, what was interesting was some of these pastoralists talked about how proud they were of their 1,000 animals. Mm-hmm. One son was often equally proud and saying, "I'm staying," but there was often a second son or daughter that were like, "I'm going to the mm-hmm. to the city."
There are stock owners who have 7,000 stock. Hired labor, market-oriented production, you see, et cetera, if you want, capitalist development.
Yeah, it's a new reality. It's a brave, brave new world. You
like. Following up on Anatoly, I should make one footnote and then I have a question. That reminds me about what I hear about like large-scale farms in Tatarstan as well, that this is probably a phenomenon all across the former Soviet space. My question is, a number of us were in Bloomington for the Central Eurasian Studies Society conference, and the Mongolia Society organized a whole day series of panels on Mongolia, and the big topic there was the mining, or the prospects for mining. And so, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're not a political scientist, and I'm not a political scientist, so we don't have any rules that we can't make predictions about. it sounds like, I mean, so much of your paper was about, you know, urban, rural, rural, urban migration, and things like that. If mining does go forward in Mongolia, and even that, I guess, is a question mark, because they're wondering who's paying millions or hundreds of millions of dollars for what purpose, But if that goes, it sounds like it has the potential to really, really profoundly transform the picture that you laid out. And so I guess I shouldn't ask you to make any predictions, but based upon what we know of similar situations around the world, I mean, by making comparisons or just thinking out loud, I mean, how do you expect that this picture might be different in 10 years from now? I mean, I don't know, for example, in what regions of Mongolia you would have mining. Does it mean that we should expect that you should get a tremendous amount of migration within the country from Ulaanbaatar or other rural areas to centers of mining? Does it mean that we should expect some in-migration because there's not enough labor? I mean,
migration to the mining areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's a really interesting question because a lot of the mining that occurred during the Soviet period, the miners were often Kazakhs in Mongolia, because a lot of times the Mongolians would kind of wave it up like, that's digging in the ground, that's too agricultural. The Kazakhs were stepping up and saying, we're nomads too, but we will take that job. You're seeing a lot more openness among the Mongolians to taking those mining jobs now. And I think you will see a lot more movement to those areas because the pay is good. I wonder if you will see an increased in my migration, and that raises large-scale questions if it's transnational and they pull from China. Because those types of concerns about Chinese migration are still there. The other big one, though, is this. And the Millennium Highway and the highways that are likely to shoot off of it, mining highways, because a lot of these big mining companies are building their own paved roads. And Mongolia is one of the least paved countries in the whole world in terms of the size of the country and the percentage of roads actually paved. The mining companies are building paved roads. I think that has a great potential to alter the patterns of mobility in this country, and in doing so, alter a lot of the patterns of social, cultural, and economic life. And one of the big ones that I actually wonder about, and this comes from some of the work that Anatolia has done, is what if you start to get some people settling along the roads to develop gas stations and shops and small towns and all that? And what if that leaves some people, specific people, who decide, I want to stay in the pastoral region? It could actually, in some ways, save pastoral nomadism by enabling them to actually do this without the sort of overcrowding that could exist now if everybody feels like they have to stay with it. Yes.
Have you seen any evidence of an effort to kind of sustain the nomadic herder lifestyle? I mean, in Wisconsin, you know, we're trying to save the family farm. Is there some kind of an equivalent sort of effort happening in Mongolia that's trying to keep the people out on the steppe?
There has certainly been government action to sort of try to stave off this large-scale migration to the city, particularly to Ulaanbaatar, because these Gare suburbs have been growing and growing, and they've been kind of like, what do we need to do to keep you on the steppe? So some of that exists. Some of that actually plays into some of this mobility stuff, that if they can actually facilitate the movement of goods to the city, where a lot of those subsidies fell. Some of that used to be subsidized during the Soviet period. You could get your stuff in by a government truck. Now it's a privatized truck. There's a cost related there too. But there's also this traditional group that really is pushing the idea that our Mongolian pastoral nomadic heritage has to be kept at the center of this nationalizing process. The fear that we'll lose ourselves to this global world if we don't hold tight to it. There's that other group that is looking at them and saying, we can do it in the form of those concrete gares, of those giant gare buildings. And those two things, that's why I call it a complex negotiation, because that's not an easy one. There's a lot of people on both sides of that who want both. And hopefully they can find some way to figure that out that will be truly respectful and in some sense authentic to the traditions of the state. Yeah?
Yeah. Can Could you tell us a little bit more about what a lot of people call ninja mining and how that affects the pastoralist and urban tension going on? Because I think that's a major way how the developing mining industry in Mongolia affects the lives of the nomads as well as people's decision whether they want to move to the city or not. That's one thing. And another thing is, to what extent do you think the socioeconomic line plays a role on the definition of this urban landscape? Like, for example, I think a lot of the modern statues and things that you talked about has been built by and owned by the major companies, and I think many people in Ulaanbaatar would, for example, say that, you know, it's kind of a way for them to express their wealth and their power. So you could tell us your thoughts on that.
Okay. I wish I knew more about the ninja mining. I mean, my familiarity with it was basically through interviews with different families and finding out that one of their sons had decided to take this up. They often call them the ninja miners because they wear this sort of the large panning dishes on their back, and they end up looking like those ninja turtles heading out there. So I don't have a great answer there in terms of impact.
Alex, by the way, another consideration. This mining opened a lot of possibilities for the stock owners. High demand, meat, milk products. So those who have their households relatively close to mining are becoming quite wealthy and prosperous.
Right, right. Just proximity to them adds to it. Yeah, this is one of the great complexities of doing this kind of urban research, because you end up looking at it and trying to find out who sponsored that statue, who put that in, what were they hoping for, and that's where it gets so interesting. And that kind of like museum research, when you go in, you're supposed to see it in a certain way. You're supposed to walk through and see it. But when you interview people coming out, they often see it in a very different way. And you do those interviews, kind of exit interviews. And that's what I tried to do here with some of these people looking at some of these new statues and say, how do you see that? How do you interpret that? And there were people who kind of looked at the Marco Polo statue in particular with some real question. Like, why are we putting that up there? Why are we celebrating him? Gandhi, okay, but why this guy? Yeah, because, I mean, what did he do for us? And thus, I then asked the people inside the big glass building, who went, of course, Marco Polo. You know, he's the one that introduced Europe to the great Khan's throne. Yeah? Hope that answers your question.
So going back to the gear districts, I'm interested in ecological health, as you know, and I mean, like you say, the gear districts are expanding, and they're probably going to continue to expand. I'm interested, again, like what you said about smog and air pollution, and I've read that 70% of the air pollution is attributed to the gear districts alone because of the use of coal and burning wood and dung. And so that's a big chunk, that's a big percentage, and the reality is it's going to be expanding, yet the gear is so integral to the Mongolian identity, and yet, like you say, this sedimentary lifestyle with the gear there is causing a lot of problems, not just identity-wise, but in terms of health of the people. So, I mean, what is your perspective on the gear districts, you know, just their existence, and you know, there's a lot of initiatives going on right now to replace the stoves with more, you know, energy efficient, whatnot. I mean, it's just amazing that, you know, the most vulnerable people to this air pollution are the ones that are contributing to the air pollution. So it's very complicated, and I just wanted to know. I mean, complete removal is out of the question, obviously. I think the government is now thinking about, you know, trying to integrate them into the city center, but like, I don't know, it just seems like what is being done, what is being talked about. I mean, air pollution is a huge problem there, and I don't know.
Yeah, and You're right. You can't just go out there and clear them off, right? There is a lot of talk of improving the technology there, the stoves and all that, providing some type of clean burning heat producer there. And I've heard about that too. You'll also see some people within the city trying to use this pollution problem to leverage something like, I remember reading about them talking about trying to build a metro, you know, to alleviate this huge problem that we have with car pollution. And others going, it's not the cars. The cars are part of it, but it's the Gare suburbs that are really doing this. But think about this. Who's building these now? Who's going to build the big, fast Khrushchev-era concrete blockies that were affordable? Because they're not building those so much now. You know, they're building these. And these are not affordable by the people who live in the Gare suburbs. Now, maybe there's some movement from the big blockies into these, but not enough to actually house. And so the shortage of permanent housing is something that they've almost come to say, we have to actually live with this. So we have to somehow find a way of fixing the Gare suburbs and making them more livable, because they are a reality of our new city.
So they're going to exist,
yeah,
regardless, and it's just going to continue expanding. So in a sense, it would be kind of appropriate to use the word slum. I mean, I'm just thinking of like the rich-poor gap that's taking place, I guess, and with the mining coming in, like obviously, you know, capitalist system, there's only a certain segment of the population that's going to benefit from the mining, and then...
Actually, I would say the air pollution and reducing the air pollution coming from the grid district has been a major issue, I think, in the recent political elections. And the new city mayor, for example, I think his proposal is to build those affordable, small apartments as many as they can. And they actually try to kind of also use it as a justification of signing these big mining deals as well, because this is one of the ways that people in the city can benefit from mining, because they will have the money, they will be able to build this part of the buildings and just also.
Yes.
Once they burn the wood and dome in.
A lot of them have these kind of small tinish stoves with a stove pipe that is going out the top of the gear.
Let's have a little technological development.
Yeah. But one of the other issues is some of the deforestation too. So you know, you've got Chinggis Khan actually designated entire mountain sizes as national parks. Most people don't give him credit for that, but he actually said these should be preserved. And because of this desperate need for fuel, they're burning everything. I mean, you're finding people who are going into construction.